We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to Untangle. I'm Patricia Karpus. This was a really fun interview. Our guest today is Robert Waldinger, a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, a practicing psychiatrist, Zen master, and author of the book, The Good Life, Lessons from the World's Longest Scientific Study on Happiness. This study, which began in 1938, reveals what it takes to build a good life. What does that exactly mean, I wondered? Fulfilling, satisfying, meaningful, happy, all of it. But there's no one size that fits all. The one thing that was consistent, relationships, all kinds of relationships. The quality of the social connections that we make throughout our lives means everything. He says human connection is our superpower. Good relationships help us get through life's inevitable challenges, and they keep us healthier and happier. And the research shows that they actually help us live longer. He reminds us that we should pay attention to the things that we really care about, the things and people that energize us, but also pay attention to the things and people that deplete us. He shares the keystones of healthy relationships. Things like safety and security, emotional closeness, fun and relaxation, learning and growth, and there's more. As always, we're Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband dedicated to unlocking your brain's potential and revolutionizing health, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. Check out all the free meditations at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Now, on to Robert Waldinger. Bob, welcome to Untangle. It's such a thrill and pleasure to have you on our show today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Before we get into the study that so many people have been talking about, I want to understand you. What inspired you to go into psychiatry and then to become a Zen master? Was this path out of something in your childhood? Some deep curiosity about human nature, depression, anxiety. What were you like as a child and a college student? What led you down this path?
I'm a Jew from Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I know. Everybody says, really? There are Jews in Iowa? Yes, there are Jews in Iowa. And I didn't know any psychiatrists there. There were very few. I certainly didn't know anybody who practiced meditation, let alone Zen meditation. I didn't know anybody who did this research where you followed lives over decades. So it was all a meandering along a path, and I kept finding my way, just moving toward the things that energized me, that I cared about. I used to think these were three separate silos, psychiatry and lifespan research and Zen. And then I realized, of course, they're not separate, that really, for me, there are three different windows on being human, and that probably the thing that drives all of it for me is just this curiosity about all the different ways there are to experience being alive.
When did you begin thinking, I am so curious? Were you dissatisfied with the Jewish religion? Was your family not spiritual or spiritual? How did that all fall together for you?
My family was very Jewish, very involved with their local synagogue. I was very involved. I was president of my youth group at my synagogue. And the problem was that over time, I realized I didn't believe in God. And I used to sit there in services at our synagogue and have this fantasy of stopping the service, of running up to the front and saying, okay, everybody, raise your hands. How many of you really believe this? But of course, I didn't do that because my parents would have been appalled. But no, we were kind of an observant, believing family. And I still love being Jewish.
I understand. How did you know not to believe in God? I'm trying to understand. Did you have some innate wisdom as a child? Did you look for God to solve a problem for you? How did you know or believe that there was no God for you?
For me, it was more an absence of faith. I'm really envious of the people I know who believe in God, who have real faith. In fact, one of my closest friends kept making the case for God, and it just didn't do it for me. I don't know why, but I've often actually felt it more as an absence for me rather than something I was wise enough to figure out. And I think a lot of it had to do with thinking about the world and also thinking about myself and realizing I'm one tiny, tiny corner of the universe. And there isn't one being sitting on a throne that cares about whether I make this free throw in basketball or whether I get an A on this test. You know, and I used to imagine, well, there needs to be somebody like that. Or God forbid that people get killed in the Middle East. All of that, I began to say, for me, it didn't make sense that there was a supreme being guiding it all. It didn't mean that the universe isn't miraculous and wonderful as it unfolds, but it wasn't at the direction of one person, usually a guy with a white beard.
Right, like you.
Yeah, exactly.
How did you choose Zen Buddhism among all the other types of spirituality you could have chosen?
By accident.
Okay.
So my younger son was in middle school, and his friend in middle school had a coming of age ceremony at the local Unitarian church, 5-minute walk from my house. And we went to the ceremony, and the mom knew that I'd been interested in meditation, and she pointed to the minister and said, he's a Zen master. So I called him up and said, could I come talk to you? And I was looking for meditation, for relaxation. I was not looking for Zen. I was not looking for a deep spiritual path at all. And then I got hooked. Then I realized I was looking for something more profound for me, something to really help me with the big questions about being alive. And Zen was what I found that really helps me with that.
Was it the rituals or the meditation? I love Buddhist philosophy, and I tried Zen retreats several times when I was younger, and I just couldn't adhere to the strictness of it. I like to meditate. Like, I wake up in the morning, I can sit up and lean back on my pillow and meditate, or I can sit on my couch and meditate, or I can listen to guided meditations. And I love, like, Koshin and Chodo, who had introduced me to you. They're Zen masters as well. And I love what they teach, but I just could never really grasp the Zen meditation style and teachings. So I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, Zen is not for most people. I really believe that. That there's something about these spiritual traditions that either call to you or they don't. And there's no reason why they should call to you if they don't. So I don't know why. But the first time I went to one of those retreats that made you feel like, I can't do this, I was like, sign me up for the next one. I think also for me, I'm a Harvard professor. I'm so about accomplishing things. I am the ultimate A student. And so for me, this non-doing, there is nothing to attain, which is a mantra we say in Zen a lot. was so radical for me and actually so freeing that for me, it was like, oh, I really need this.
Yeah. And the discipline of it as a professor and as the student that you had been for so many years was probably not as difficult as it is for some other people. So do you teach Zen meditation or do you teach all kinds of meditation?
Just Zen. I teach online every Monday night in newtonzen.org. I've actually started writing a newsletter as a way to try to put Zen concepts and some of my experiences in Zen into language that non-Zen people can understand and maybe resonate with. So I'm trying to do Zen for the non-Zen people in the world.
It makes so much sense for you to be doing that because you work so diligently through your book, through your teachings, through everything that you do to help people live their best life, to feel better about themselves.
There's something for me about explaining things. If I can explain it, then I understand it a lot better. I'm sure you've had this experience that when you teach something, you really know it in a different way. And so what I'm finding is if I can explain some of the science that I do, some of the Zen concepts, if I can explain them in ways that don't rely on jargon, that I know it better.
Yeah, let's try to integrate some of the Zen concepts as we're talking about the study that you have been directing, this Harvard study of adult development, which started in 1938. Clearly, directors have handed it off to other directors, and now you have been leading this. Share a little bit about that study for people that haven't heard about it and how it began and where it is today.
It's the longest study of the same people going through their lives that's ever been done, as far as we know. So we're in our 86th year studying the same families. That's like unheard of. Like most studies that try to follow people through their lives fall apart before the 10-year mark. My predecessors were so dedicated and dogged, and our study participants were so dedicated and generous that we started with people in 1938, two groups, a group of Harvard undergrads, and it was meant to be a study of normal young adult development from adolescence to young adulthood. Now, normal young adult development means all white men from Harvard. It's the most politically incorrect sample you could have. So we're constantly having to explain why it still is worth funding us. But then the other study, that study was started at the Harvard Student Health Service. The other study was started at Harvard Law School by Sheldon Gluck and Eleanor Gluck, who were interested in the problem of juvenile delinquency and particularly why some kids from really troubled families managed to stay on good developmental paths. And so they chose kids who were not in trouble. They were on average age 14 at the time, again in 1938. But they were from not just poor families, but families who were known on average to like five social service agencies in the city of Boston for domestic violence, parental, mental illness, physical illness, extreme poverty, all that. And yet these kids were doing okay. And so the question was, what allowed them to do okay? So now we have 724 of them. We brought in their spouses. And then eventually we've been studying their kids, most of whom are baby boomers. So now it's close to 3,000 people in 724 families.
And ages right now are from what to what?
There are a few people left in the original generation, fewer than 30, and they're late 90s, early 100s. And then the children are all baby boomers. So their average age is about 65.
So interesting. So we're going to talk a bit about the study. You named your book, The Good Life. And so right away, I was curious, how do you define a good life? How do you measure a good life? I know some of the conclusions that you came to, but when you set out or when this study was handed to you, what in your mind constituted a definition for a good life?
What we wanted to show people in the book was how many ways there are to go through life, how many paths there are. And that there is no one good life. In some ways, there's some irony in that title. because there's no single formula. And that's one of the things we really want to show people, that there's so many ways to be in the world and to live your life. So we tell all these stories and mix it with the science itself to help people see these different paths. Now, that said, we know that some ways really are better than others. So what we find is that taking care of your physical health really matters. Like, it adds years to your life. And that means how you eat, getting enough sleep, not abusing alcohol or drugs, not smoking, getting regular exercise, all those things that our grandmothers could have told us. But they really play out in numbers of years of longevity. So that's one. But then the other big finding, which we didn't believe at first, was that the people who were not just happiest, but healthiest and lived longest were the people who were more connected to other people. That people's relationships, having warmer relationships and more relationships, predicted that you would live longer and you would stay healthier longer as you got older.
How do you come to that conclusion? What are the questions that you ask to get to the quality of a person's relationship?
We literally ask, how many people do you see in a given week? How close are you to family members? How often do you get together socially with people? We asked one question that was very telling. Who could you call in the middle of the night if you were sick or scared? And some people could list several people. Some people couldn't list anybody. Some people were married and didn't list anybody. So we asked all kinds of questions. And in addition, we did other measures that gave us different windows on well-being and relationships. So we stressed people out and saw how quickly they calmed down in our lab. We showed them different kinds of images while we scanned their brains and watched their brains light up in different patterns. We did genetic analyses and saw which genes got turned on and off among people who had more childhood stress and people who had less childhood stress. What we're trying to do is come at this whole idea of a good life and well-being from different angles, because no single lens is sufficient.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. You mentioned that you do a lot of genetic testing. Does that play a big part in this?
It does. And this doesn't come from our work, but there's a psychologist named Sonia Lubomirsky who asked the question, what percent of our happiness is under our control? And she analyzed tons of data. And what she found was she estimates about half of our happiness, our mood, is genetically based, like inborn temperament. And you probably know some people who are Tiggers and they're always bouncy, and some people who are Eeyores, no matter how life is going for them. So there's that. But then what she finds is that about 10% of our happiness on any given day has to do with our current life circumstances. And then about 40%, she argues, is under our control. We can do stuff to change our mood. And you can either see 40% as a little or a lot.
I think it's interesting, the genetic piece of this, because how does that impact your study?
In 1938, DNA wasn't even dreamed of. So what's really cool is we're now using measures. And if someone told you in 1938, you could put people in this machine and look at the inside of their brains and watch their brains light up, people would have said, that's outer space. That's science fiction. So what's really fun is that we get to bring new methods in to study well-being that weren't imagined when the founders began the study.
That is so exciting. What are you seeing over the course of a lifetime? What were some of the things that you discovered about a good life that aligned with the chapter of life that you're in? So you started talking about adolescents and young adults, but then you follow them through these different decades of their lives. Are there different things that constitute a good life at different chapters of your life? And what were those findings?
Well, that's a really important question, because my predecessor, George Valiant, was one of the first people who said, there's a whole lot of development all the way through adulthood. And there's a whole lot of change that used to be thought, once you get into your 20s, you find a partner, you find work, you're kind of done. You're kind of who you are. And of course, that's not the case. I mean, think about what life looks like to you now and what it looked like to you when you were 25. It's so different. Actually, Eric Erickson, the psychologist, talked about these different developmental, they're not crises exactly, but they are dialectics. And he said that as you go through life, the big developmental tasks change for you. So young adulthood is a time of what he called intimacy versus isolation. And that means, like, am I ever going to find somebody to love and who will love me? That's a big preoccupation for a lot of people in young adulthood. But then in midlife, as people begin to get more of a sense of, oh, this mortality thing is real, I really might die. He talks about generativity versus stagnation. So generativity meaning caring for the well-being of the next generation. And that could be parenting, but it could also be mentoring people in your work life, in your hobbies, in wherever. So it becomes a concern for what will be here when I'm gone. And then later in life, he talks about integrity versus despair. And what he's referring to is this idea that you look back on your life and say, was my life good enough? Or despair, did I waste my life? And he said, all of us have to do some of that as we get older, if we live that long. That's a very long way of answering your question, but it's really important because how life looks to us changes. Really, it's the closer we get to mortality.
It's so interesting because we talk about relationships here, and the quality of the relationships that you have make you happier, give your life more meaning, according to your study. You've probably read the studies that show that there's a happiness U curve, that we're happiest when we're youngest, and then that goes down in your 20s, 30s, and 40s. Maybe you're seeking, you're stressed, all the things we know that happened during those years. And then you hit, this one researcher that I interviewed said that 69 was like the happiest in his studies. That was, you were happiest. And I was like, what of your health declines? And he said, regardless of your health, you're happiest when you're older. And I'm wondering, what do you think about that? And does that jive with your...
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now, over to Untangle.
Findings.
It absolutely does. There's a psychologist at Stanford, Laura Carstensen, and she discovered something she calls the positivity effect. What she found was that as we get older, as a species, we get happier. Our mood gets better. So then she asked, well, why? How does that happen? Because you would think, I used to look at older people and say, oh, that's depressing. And it must be so depressing to be old. Well, now I'm old and it's not so bad. What Laura's work was about was looking at why. And so couple of reasons. One is probably biological. So when we're younger, our brains are programmed to be biased toward what's negative. So you scan the horizon for what might go wrong. And that's adaptive because you want to see what the threats are out there. But what that means is it's good for survival. It's not good for making us happy. If I give you 10 pieces of positive feedback about your wonderful podcast, and then I give you one negative, you're much more likely to dwell on the negative because that's the bias of our minds. But what Laura found, Laura and other scientists found that this bias reverses. And so instead of paying more attention to the negative when we're younger, we pay more attention to the positive when we're older and we remember the positive better. And Laura also found that part of it has to do with the awareness of mortality, that as people realize they're going to die, rather than making most of us more depressed, it actually makes us savor the time we have left. And it makes us make those changes that make us happier. So we stop going to those meetings that we've hated for a long time. We stop seeing those friends who have annoyed us for years, but we feel obliged to keep seeing them. And we turn toward the things that make us happier. And that the cumulative effect of that process is we are happier more of the time.
Yeah, it sounds like gratitude plays a big role in that as well.
Yeah.
Can you share more of the questions that you ask in the study?
So we ask about life satisfaction. On the whole, how satisfied are you with your life? And you rate it from 1 to 10. How satisfied are you with your partner? How often do you argue? What do you argue about the most? We ask, how long do you think you're going to live? Because it turns out that how long you think you're going to live actually predicts how long you will live. Not exactly. But the people who think they're going to live longer turn out on average to live longer. We don't know why that is exactly.
How often are you giving the questionnaires to your participants?
So on average, we gave them questionnaires every 2 years. We got medical records from their doctors with their permission every 5 years. And we would interview them. We'd go to their living rooms and interview them maybe every 10 to 15 years. It's a whole lot of things on different schedules.
I was wondering, when you're in a situation, let's say you're 30 years old and you're looking for a job and someone's asking you a set of questions, you're going to answer them one way. When you're 50 and you're looking back at what happened when you were 30, you might answer them in a completely different way. What is that distinction between how we live our lives and how we look back on our lives?
That's a fabulous question. It is. And we think about that a lot because you're right. Remembering things changes the memory. We know that from really good cognitive experiment. To say, well, look back on your 30s now and tell me what they were like. We know you're going to commit some systematic errors. You're going to be more likely to forget the stuff that wasn't emotionally alive, but might have been important. It just wasn't emotionally salient. Dan Schachter is a psychologist who wrote a book called The Seven Sins of Memory. In it, he talks about these systematic ways that we alter our memories. And so you're asking a really good question. And that's why we try to go back to people often. And we try to do more than just ask them to remember. That's why we bring them into our lab and run various tests.
Interesting. How has directing this study changed you personally and changed your life, changed your family's life?
My younger son, who's 32, says, Dad, I don't want to work as hard as you worked. But that said, it certainly made me appreciate being with the people we care about. So even though my son said that, I spent a lot of time with my kids, and it was quite deliberate because I saw in our study how important it was to be present, to just show up. There was for a while this idea that, well, if you spend quality time, it's okay. You don't need to spend that much time. No, you need to just show up and often and a lot. And it made me do that both with my kids. From the time they were infants, there were times of the week when Jennifer, my wife, was working and I would be the only parent. And I made sure I did that every week, regularly, multiple times, because that way I wasn't a visitor parent. I was the primary parent along with my wife. I came from a generation where the dads didn't do that stuff. So this research taught me that's important. The other thing is that I spend more time taking care of my relationships. So I ask my friends to go out to dinner or to take a walk. And in fact, some of my male friends, we laugh about it because we never used to do that. We would let our wives arrange the social life and we would go out as couples. So now, for years now, I've been making sure that with the people I really want to stay in touch with, I have regular contact. My co-author, Mark Schultz, who I wrote the book with, every Friday at noon, including today, we're on the phone with each other. He lives in Pennsylvania, but we're on the phone. And yes, we talk about our work, but we talk about our kids and we gossip. That's our default. We have to cancel that appointment if we don't want to do it. And so that's the kind of thing I've learned to set up.
That's awesome. I've always valued connections quite a bit. But since reading the book, when I wake up in the morning, I'll meditate or write in my journal. Now I look at my text. I know this isn't the best way to connect, but I'm like, who do I want to connect with today? And who do I want to check in on? And who wasn't feeling well that I want to make sure they're okay?
I know we're not supposed to text and email. It's not as good. But boy, it beats nothing.
That's so important to value our primary relationship, but also our friendships. There's so much value to that. What do you say? Maybe this is a little more macro question, but we live in a culture that values things like fame and fortune and status above so many other things. And yes, you know this. And you write a book that tells you that's not the most important thing. But what else can you say to that?
Zen really helped me with that. One of the things that got me into Zen was being part of this whole world of academic achievement. So maybe for me, it's not becoming a billionaire, it's becoming a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. And I realized in high school, I think, we're all chasing after these things and nobody's going to care. In 50 years, we're all going to be dead or 100 years and nobody's going to know what we did or care what we did. So why are we all chasing after these things? Zen really helped. Literature really helps. Studying these lives really helps. Because the things we found were that, when people were in their 80s, we asked them to look back on their lives and we asked them, what are you proudest of? And what do you regret the most? And to a person, they were proudest of something to do with their relationships. I was a good parent. I was a good boss. I was a good partner. Nobody said, I was a good editor of the Washington Post, and Ben Bradley was in our study. But they didn't talk about their accomplishments. They talked about the people.
It's interesting because all of the things that you've done as a psychiatrist, a professor, a Zen master, they are all areas where you are of service to other people. So I would imagine that at the end of your life, you would say the relationships were important because you know that and you have prioritized that. But your life has been one of service. So the things that you've done that you aspire to and your accomplishments, they are of significance.
But for me, the significance, so the book was a New York Times bestseller. And that's great. I'm happy. But what's really exciting is when somebody texts me or emails me and says, your book is making such a difference in how I'm leading my life. It's not so much the accomplishment for me as it is if I've made a difference in somebody's life. So I'm a Zen priest. That's part of it. And being a priest is a vow of service. In Buddhism, as you probably know, it's about relieving suffering. So if I can be of some help, it means more to me than making the New York Times bestseller list.
But you had to accomplish what you've accomplished. You had to study what you studied. You probably had to prioritize at certain times throughout your life these accomplishments to get to that place where there's some ease.
You're right. And maybe I'm presenting this in too simple a fashion because it's always a set of choices that are hard to make. I'm still making choices every day.
What advice would you give to, let's say, a 20-year-old today or to your younger self? What advice would you give in terms of how to have a good life?
I would say pay attention to the things that you really care about and that energize you, and pay attention to the people you care about and who energize you, and turn away from those things that you're supposed to like, or those people you're supposed to like, but you really don't. Really pay attention to those signals that come from inside. I think we're raised to be good doobies, at least I was, which means you suppress a lot of the signals that come from inside. And it took me a while to realize, oh, wow, I really do know more about the stuff I care about and the stuff I don't care about if I can just learn to listen to it again.
That's very, very good advice. When you talk about these two crucial predictors in relationships, I think it applies to everything we do in life in a way, what energizes you and what depletes you. And people that are doing work that just drains, and there's no energy, that's a good sign that that may be not for you.
Right. We don't always have choice. So some people have to do work that they don't like. So then I think what I would say is, if you can, find ways to connect with people, even in your workplace. So you might have some energy, some joy, some nourishment from connecting with people, even around work that is just kind of ho-hum or you don't like very much.
You have a chapter called Attention to Relationships. As I was reading that, I was like, should this be organic, what we feel? That's the attention we place on our relationships? Or is there a right effort to put into our relationships?
There is a right effort, because think about it. There's some relationships that we need, but that aren't so fun. Maybe we have a partner who we don't get along with that well, but maybe we've made a whole life together. Maybe we have kids together. And so you don't just walk away from that. So we spend a lot of time making the effort to see, can this get better? Can I help make it better? As opposed to just saying, I'm sorry, you don't light me up, I'm leaving. On the other hand, we know there are some relationships that have to be walked away from, particularly violent ones. But I think that right effort means making the effort that's going to lead to something that we feel is worthwhile. Like, this relationship is worthwhile. Making a home for my family is worthwhile. Or for me, it's like, there's a lot of stuff about my research that's unbelievably boring. And I could list so much that's just so tedious. So I have to come back to, why am I doing this? And so the right effort is to say, I am going to put up with this administrative stuff that I hate doing because I want to study these lives, but I have to keep coming back to it.
You have to know your why.
Yeah.
The big picture. What do you have, place a value on intimate relationships versus friendships? And I asked this question because I interviewed Marisa Franco, who wrote a book called Platonic, and she said that friendships get a bad rap. They shouldn't be at the bottom of the relationship totem pole. Is that consistent with anything that you found in the study?
Yes. I guess what I would say is we don't want to rank them, because for some people, when you study all these lives, you realize one size never fits all. So for some people, their partner may be the core of their life, and that's it. For other people, their partner is a good partner, but their real heart and soul is with a couple of friends or a sibling. One of my colleagues, Eli Finkel, wrote a book called The All or Nothing Marriage, where he talks about, we can assume we're supposed to get everything from our partner, and that's not realistic. So I think that what we want to do is discern, where is the connection, and how can I nurture and maintain that connection with friend, with a relative, with my partner, even with an adult child, although that can get complicated, but yes.
What is the wiser? You have a wiser model of reacting to emotionally challenging relationships. What is that model and how important is that?
It was a model developed by a psychologist named Kenneth Dodge, and he developed it for kids, but it so applies to adults. He was studied like, what happens on the playground when a kid does something that you don't understand? Like, he throws a ball right at you. What do you do then? How do you understand it? And he studied all this and he realized we tend to fill in the blank when we don't know why somebody does something. And we often fill in the blank in ways that aren't true, especially negatively. I think we use the example in the book of, you get an email from your boss at 5 o'clock saying, I want to see you in my office first thing tomorrow.
The worst.
And that's all.
Off to the races.
Exactly. You find yourself filling in the blank. And so the wiser model just says, slow it down. pay attention, take into account, okay, have you ever gotten one of these before from your boss? And what was involved then? And what might be going on now? It's really just a way of keeping yourself from jumping to conclusions when you don't have to about relationships.
Gotcha. Okay. I think this might be my final question, but I can't promise that. You talk about the keystones of a healthy relationship. And because your study focuses so much, almost every chapter is really about relationships, different relationships in your life. What would you say some of the keystones of the healthiest relationships are?
Yeah. One is mutuality. Like the healthiest relationships have a real give and take. And it's not like one person does all the taking and the other person does all the giving. That soon gets really old and tiring. So there's that. There's curiosity, especially for a long relationship. If you think about it, we're all changing all the time. That's from my Buddhist background, but you just watch people change. How different are you from how you were 20 years ago? You've changed. So part of it is watching and being curious about each other and noticing, well, who are you today? And how are you different from the last time I saw you? And then also letting each other change. So for example, when my wife and I got together, I'd never heard of Zen meditation. I was not into that. Suddenly I'm like in this deep dive.
She married a Zen priest.
Exactly. It's like,
who are you?
Exactly. She calls it my great big hobby. And she's not into Zen at all, but she's really supportive of me doing it because she sees that it's important to me. And I think that if we can allow each other to change and support each other when we can in making changes that are right for us, rather than being threatened by when we change, that's a really helpful pillar for a good, enduring relationship.
Yeah, I love that one. And that takes a certain level of maturity because you take out any competition or jealousy. You want your partner to be happy and fulfilled and continuously learn and become who they are most comfortable being in the world. There were so many gems in the book. Are there any giant gaps that we might have missed in our discussion?
Actually, two things. It's easy from all this talk about happiness and well-being to think if you just do the right things, you'll be happy all the time. So just find the right formula. No life is happy all the time. And on the one hand, that's stating the obvious, but you could look at other people's curated lives on social media and think they've got it figured out. And I'm the only one who's not happy all the time. Nobody's happy all the time. And so let's just name that. The other thing I would say is that you could take away from this that you have to have a whole lot of friends and you should probably be a party animal to be a healthy person. That's also not true, that we're all on a spectrum from introverts to extroverts. And there's nothing better about one than the other. What it means is that, for example, introverts get more of their energy from having time alone to refuel. So introverts may just need one or two really close, good relationships. And otherwise, a lot of people around is stressful compared to extroverts who may want a lot of people around because that's how they get their energy. So I think it's just worth naming that so that the introverts among our listeners don't say, well, I'm clearly doing it wrong. No, you're not doing it wrong at all.
Which are you? Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
I'm an introvert who's learned to be somewhat extroverted. I was a shy kid and a geeky kid and felt like I didn't fit in. And I've gotten more extroverted with time, but I still have that side of me that's shy and I don't like walking into cocktail parties. It scares me.
I can totally understand that. Wow, there's so much great stuff here. Are there any Zen practices that you would recommend for people that wanted to begin studying or exploring Zen?
Sure. I would say there's some very good apps out there, and you could use an app to try short meditations. And often guided meditations are a good way to start, where someone is talking you through it. And just do a 5-minute guided meditation on one of the many good apps and see how you feel afterwards. And if you feel like, ooh, I might like to do that again, then do it again sometime. If you say, I hated that, you don't need to do it again. Do something else.
I love it. Okay. This is so great. Thank you. This is fantastic. So grateful for your time today. And thank you for writing this book and sharing all of this great information with us.
This was a lovely interview. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today. You can check out the book, The Good Life, at all major booksellers. If you're interested in his Zen classes, check out robertwaldinger.com. When you have a minute, explore the meditations at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Any questions, suggestions, comments, reach out to us at untangle@choosemuse.com. And we'd love if you'd write a review for us. It helps a lot. Have a great week, and we will see you next time.